Hi, everyone, and thanks for tuning in for the latest episode of our podcast series, The Broadstone Broadcast. I hope you're having a good day, and wherever you are while you're listening to this, maybe sat in the car in traffic or out walking the dog, the rest of the day is kind to you. Very pleased to say that today we are joined by a very interesting guest, Mr. John Ronayne. John is lead data scientist at ULife. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Rod.
Perhaps you could start by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and what your current role in the industry is.
Yeah, of course. Dr. John Ronayne, I work at ULife as the lead data scientist here. My background in data science and generally insurance is a bit far from initially where I started off. My qualifications come in theoretical physics. I started off doing theoretical physics and mostly cosmology as part of my undergraduate and master's, and then followed on to do a PhD and postdoc in that. So it's a bit of a long journey, several light years from there to here. And when eventually I left academia, I wanted to join something a bit more, I'll begin kind of a career in something a bit more impactful in terms of working in the real world and industry, seeing maybe where, say, artificial intelligence was becoming quite popular, how I could kind of get into that world. And then that led me to working with a few companies, so faculty and street bees, and trying to understand consumer trends, and in particular with natural language processing. Now, at the time, things like ChatGPT weren't really that popular, wasn't even around at that point. So I was working on very early models in natural language processing to try and understand, say, trends in consumer behavior. Now, after some time, I discovered ULife and their kind of mission, and it was really exciting, and I decided to join them on their adventure. And that led me to here at to ULife, and in particular, what we're doing in terms of, I guess, the world of AI in ULife is how do we kind of incorporate, say, predictive health analytics, understanding behavioral trends, and incorporating machine learning into this kind of new world of data to better help employees to understand health, and really to try and give those nudges and cleverly do it to impact health overall.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you for that. I think it's it is, as you say, quite the leap from cosmology to health and protection insurance. So for those of the listeners who aren't familiar with ULife, perhaps, could you tell us just a little bit about the brand, what it does, and where it tries to be different in our market?
Yeah, for sure. So ULife is quite an innovative insurtech company. So we combine insurance products with a wellness app, with kind of the mission, our mission effectively, to inspire healthier living and happier lives by rewarding people through the app by engaging in sort of their everyday wellness activities. So we believe that effectively insurance can be a force for good. And so we promote that through all different mechanisms in the app itself to promote well-being holistically for every user who engages in it. And why we see that kind of coupling with insurance is that this kind of positive reinforcement on their healthy habits means that those individuals adjust their kind of lifestyle, adjust their kind of everyday healthy habits. And that ultimately results in better health and lower risk, which can impact insurance and insurance premiums. So what we do is effectively we supply this app along with our insurance products, and users are rewarded for activities like walking, meditation, doing workout challenges, even for doing small little things like doing a daily Sudoku. It's part of a feature just to get them engaged in the app. And in that app itself contains their insurance policies, their EAP services, everything that's available to them. And that means that we create a system with high levels of engagement. That means that the employees themselves have very good accessibility to all of the benefits that are being provided to them by their company. And we think that this approach, and this is exactly what we're trying to understand from a scientific perspective, ultimately results in overall healthier profiles among an employee population and lower risk in general. So that's effectively what ULife is and what we're really promoted, we're promoting in terms of healthy living.
So just picking up on something you mentioned towards the end there about the science piece of what ULife do and looking to prove with data the link between engagement, activity, well-being and long-term health. That really gets us onto the subject that I was hoping to talk about today, which is the Knowledge Transfer Partnership. For the benefit of our listeners, the Knowledge Transfer Partnership is a project that ULife have been working on with several clients and organisations over the last few months. One of those is Broadstone. It's something we're very excited about, very keen to see what it produces and to be part of it. So John, for our listeners, can you just talk in more detail about what the Knowledge Transfer Partnership is and what is it seeking to achieve?
Of course. So the Knowledge Transfer Partnership is part of an initiative by Innovate UK that connects universities with companies like ourselves in order to convert that science into innovation and ultimately produce some good products in the industry that we can then help individuals with in sort of a wider holistic society. So the project that we're doing with the KTP is not just effectively for us to understand how we're impacting health, but how techniques such as behavioral change, true gamification, can impact health on a wider societal level. So that's effectively what we're trying to investigate. We're using the KTP project as a scientific measure that measures the impact of gamification on behavioral change within a user basis. So what we're going to be doing in this is conducting randomized control trials using our app with the aim to demonstrate how engagement levels in the app impact health outcomes. So the idea that this research will ultimately help us refine our product and demonstrate the value of our approach as well, while also proving something very valuable from a scientific perspective, which is that gamification as a mechanism for behavioral change can be the most effective way to promote healthier habits. And that's in line with what our approach and our hypothesis is. And that's what the Knowledge Transfer Partnership is. It's doing this trial. It's creating a sort of mechanism for which we can develop some tools to understand risk and that we can combine them together to show that risk has been reduced by engaging in the ULife app by mechanisms of, say, users engaging in gamification features, such as what we offer in the app itself.
So you talk about randomized controlled trials there. Post-pandemic, that's a phrase some people will be familiar with when it comes to things like vaccine development and the development of medicines. When it comes to, when we talk about this context, what that means for Broadstone as a participant in the project, but also for other employers that are participating in the study, what that means in practice is that we roll out the ULife app to our employees, but on a random basis, 50% of those employees get the full fat version of the app, if you like, and 50% get a very slimmed down, very basic version of the app that might count steps and award some U-coin for those steps, but doesn't feature those team challenges, those individual challenges, those pull factors that are designed to keep people engaged and keep them coming back. Now that we're a few months into the project and you've started to see some preliminary findings, what is the data telling you? Albeit it's early stages, what insights have you gained so far?
Yeah, so the insights have been actually quite positive so far. They are something as we expected, but it's really nice that when your expectations are validated, especially in a study as such. So in our case, as you've mentioned, we have a intervention group and a control group. So we're really testing a digital health intervention instead of, say, any kind of vaccine, for example. And in doing so, the intervention group, which has that full fat experience of having access to game features, which encourage them to try out, say, different challenges. You have events where people have like a certain time period to do a certain number of challenges. You have duels where people have to challenge colleagues. Really assessing all of the different features of behavioral intervention, like competitiveness, collaboration, even just wanting to achieve things by yourself, versus the alternative, which is just incentivization. So you're giving people Ucoin, which is our in-app currency, which can be redeemed for vouchers or real monetary sort of vouchers in that case, or just discounts. So there's a monetary outcome to it. We've seen that just giving people money in terms of an incentive to go out and walk isn't as effective as if they have to come up with their own strategies, their own system, their own kind of game experience to maximize their Ucoin earning. So if you give them the same, if they earn that money versus simply just giving them that money, they'll end up walking more, they'll end up being more physically active, they'll end up engaging in more activities that are better for their well-being because they figured out which strategy works well for them. And giving that exploratory piece for them to go and discover things means they might actually do something they haven't done before. They might do a workout challenge they haven't tried before. They might start doing duels with doing walking challenges. So how many steps one colleague can do over the other the next day. They might enjoy that and they might see a more different side to exercise that isn't just simply a task that they need to complete. It becomes something fun and enjoyable, an experience that they like. So that fundamentally is what the difference is. And what we see is that there is a greater increase in people's physical activity in that intervention group that's directly associated with their engagement in those particular game features. So in general, the kind of results that we're seeing is for the group that is engaging in those game features, on average, it's been a 10 to 20% improvement in their daily average steps, which has a direct association with their longevity, with a lot of other health factors. In the group that just simply has the control group, which just simply has a incentivization, we see about a 5 to 8% improvement in their steps. So we see an improvement in both, but a significantly bigger improvement in the group that has the game features attached to it, which is obviously quite encouraging. So again, very early stages in this study. We still have about 6 months more to go, but encouraging so far. If we go into a little bit of detail into that, so we might say, okay, you're looking at one big group. What are the features they're engaging in? When you look at the specific group of users who are engaging in the social features, so checking out leaderboards, dueling each other, or even just doing challenges that are related to walking, we see that that particular group have about a 30 to 50% increase in their steps relative to the baseline period where they didn't have access to these games. So that's what we're really examining in these two different cohorts, is a sort of longitudinal thing of how over time they're increasing their steps versus the comparison between the control and intervention group. And that's quite encouraging for us.
So it sounds like what you're saying here is that when it comes to well-being programs, having agency in the program, being an active participant in the program, actually drives a higher level of activity than simply being the passive recipient of, you know, rewards for doing stuff. And that gamification is the way to create that agency, to create that active participation.
100%. It's to an extent, it's that element of feeling like you have control over your own system of maximizing your health holistically. And that's not forcing people to do one particular task or doing another task. It's giving them the option to say, you can go and meditate today. I'm not going to punish you if you don't go and walk. You have the freedom to do whatever of these activities you like any single day. In fact, we'll encourage you to do some more if you like, but you don't have to. So we're taking a completely different approach from something punitive. We're saying, you'll only get rewarded for doing more. And the more you do, the more Ucoin you'll get. And from that experience, people have a much more, I guess, joyful experience with the app that they're engaging in. And then over time, they might try exploring different workouts. They might try doing, say, yoga when they might not have tried it before. They might do strength workout exercise when they haven't tried doing it before. And the way we try and kind of mix it up a little bit by having this experience of, yes, you have your control, but here's a little taster of something new, is we have these in-app events that give you bonus Ucoin or extra Ucoin for, say, trying something you might not have tried before. And that's the interesting thing from what we've discovered in the study, is that in those events, we see that some people who have never done a workout before engage in it, and then they keep doing it afterwards. So it's a nice way for people to sort of explore, but also find things that they wouldn't have otherwise found before and start to enjoy it. So yes, it's a bit of a combination of both.
Okay, so we're a few months in, several months in now. As you say, you've got some initial data that's showing some promising signs to a degree, validating what you'd hoped to see, but also probably learning some new lessons as well. You mentioned earlier there are academics involved in the knowledge transfer partnership. So what happens at the next stage? What happens with this data now?
Yes, so the data has been collected, especially over the. So at this point, we're about 3 months into our initial part of the trial. There's another 6 months to go until ultimately the trial concludes, and everyone is back on the normal version of the app. In this period, data is being transferred to the university in an anonymized form. That data that's being presented to the university is being monitored to see how, over some time, engagement has changed, how these health profiles have changed, with a few objectives. One is that we can model seasonality effect. So we know for sure that our physical activity ultimately changes throughout the year. And so in order for us to make sure that we're correctly implementing these kind of event systems, or we're seeing the right data that we want to see, and we can get the sort of health outcomes that we'd like to get at the end. We'd like to model it in a way that we can see the effect even when we go into the winter months. So modeling for seasonality is something that's quite important to do at the moment. The next step of it is through the university themselves, they have access to a very large medical database called UK Biobank. With the UK Biobank, you have data that spans back about 30 years for about 600,000 participants who have been providing data about their lifestyle habits, say, for example, their daily steps, biometrics like heart rate, and all the associated health outcomes that go with that, so morbidities and mortalities. The university will be building models based on this data and the selected inputs that are relevant for this particular study. So it means that over a period of 3 to 9 months, we can take that data, input it into a model, and be able to assess what the long-term risk of these individuals are, such that we can be sensitive to the short-term changes in that. With the idea that people can maintain these healthy habits, what does that mean in terms of, down the road, what their health will look like? So that's effectively what the university will be doing for the next 3 to 6 months, is developing these models, monitoring and modeling the behavioral aspects of people's health at the moment, and being able to forecast that, of course, into the future, such that we can make a good statement about not just how we're changing people's health at the moment, but how that will affect them down the line, 5, 10, 20 years into the future.
And this is the bit where I think it gets really interesting. As Broadstone, as an employee benefits consultancy, we're dealing with clients who are, many clients who are facing some challenges at the moment. I think it's widely or increasingly understood that coming out of the pandemic, many people's lifestyles have kind of changed for the worse, perhaps. People are less active, not doing as much exercise as they were before. Rates of obesity are rising, rates of diabetes are rising, and employers who are funding private healthcare schemes have seen a significant increase in claims, and for many, that's now translating into a significant increase in premium costs this year and likely into next year as well. Trying to get ahead of those rising claims, prevention has got to be part of our strategy, and well-being has got to be part of any prevention strategy. But that means investing, perhaps at a time when employers have already had to find additional budget to fund increasing benefit costs. So being able to demonstrate a return on investment, a long-term return on investment for spending on well-being and prevention programs is going to be critical in the years ahead. So Ulife are a company that work with insurers, as you say. You work with MetLife and Allianz and Bupa. What kind of data are you hoping to get out of this that you might be able to share with your insurer partners that could come into play in terms of pricing of benefits in the longer term?
Yeah, so this is exactly where the KTP, from a perspective of giving an open forum for which we can share this data publicly. So in a sense, when we do these studies, all the data is collected, sufficiently anonymized, becomes available from a peer review perspective, which means that our validation study is equally reviewable by insurers from that perspective. And any models that we build to sort of understand the risk is equally available from those insurers to be able to validate as well. So it gives us that benefit of creating open source models that any individual out there can validate. With the unique perspective for ULife, at least, is that we have that key to engagement, that the app itself is our unique selling point. The key to understanding risk comes through the universities, and that's where we can have that trust and that ability to share that data and validate it through a third party like University of Essex. From the insurance perspective, they're quite interested in our proposition. Of course, we can show them the increase in, say, engagement, the increase in activity, but the translation of that into real insurance costs is where they're most interested. From our perspective, what we see is about a 5% drop in, say, the loss ratio. So where you see effectively lower claims costs when people engage with ULife over our book of business. That's effectively what we want to validate. And with this KTP, it gives the insurers who we work with that encouragement that they can go to new businesses with this new appealing offer of being potentially able to reduce their premiums in future if they couple it with a product like this. And indeed, it's also another mechanism for which customers can be retained by promising them effectively that their claims in future may be reduced by modeling two ways, what their risk is more accurately, and being able to forecast into the future that their risk reduction is going to be a function of engagement. That giving their employees access to this app would mean that maybe a year, 2 years down the line, you would see a reduction in claims cost. And if we can accurately model that, we can even price that in from the beginning. So this is the real kind of amazing piece of science that can come from this, is not understanding the risk in the past, understanding the risk now, and also understanding what risk will be like in the future as a function of engagement.
And this may be a tricky question to answer because you haven't seen the outputs from university yet. Obviously, they're only just receiving the data, but do you expect they will model health risks in a very generalized way, or are you hoping they may be able to model for specific health risks, such as cardiovascular, say?
Yeah, so we actually are working with them quite closely. The main reason why we are is because the data inputs to their model come directly from our data collection. And from that, we also have a pretty good knowledge about the data that we can collect. And we've been working quite closely with them to not only develop the tools to collect that data. For example, one of the big tools that we developed was our dynamic health questionnaire, which can capture over 300 data points from an individual, but selectively based on their individual risk profile. So it personalizes that question over time. That means that very quickly we can establish a risk profile of an individual, couple that with the continuous data that's being collected with, say, steps or with their meditation or engagement, how often they're logging in, their sleep patterns, all this continuous data that you're collecting with the dynamic health questionnaire. And that means you have the capacity to be able to build a model that can not just predict risk in terms of just one score of a mortality, but the independent reasons for why that could be the case. Why is their mortality risk, say, increasing? You can break it down into, say, cardiovascular disease. It could be cancers. It can even go further into risk of diabetes, even on other ends of it that don't necessarily always relate to mortalities, say, mental health related costs, pain and musculoskeletal conditions, even business outcomes we are attempting to model when it comes down to, say, absenteeism, the risk of an individual being off work for sick, being off work for some period of time due to sickness absence. So we're trying to encompass as much as we can while we have the university here around to help us out.
So, million-dollar question, I guess. If the project achieves most of what you hope to achieve, if you had to summarize what the potential benefits of that project could be to UK employers, how would you summarize that?
I think, for me, the personal thing I think would be the best is giving employers, in particular to HR managers who will be utilizing our services, the analytical tools to be their own mini CEO when it comes to the health of their employee bases, is that we're not just building a system which kind of works in a black box and, you know, these companies, our clients, just kind of hope that it's working. We want to be able to deliver back to them the analytics that we're seeing, that we're learning from this project, so that where there's something that we might not be able to impact, we're giving them a highlight on that. The validation of our kind of improvement of health is one aspect of it. But all the tools and the data that we're collecting is something that we're going to be building into an analytics platform that give them the power to see the whole company profile, their health profile, the risk profile, such that they have a better way of planning in future, being able to understand, you know, maybe a time of the year when there's going to be a greater degree of sickness absence, or being able to highlight parts of the company that might need specific help or care when it comes down to certain health aspects. I think that's going to be quite powerful, especially going forward, as a real selling piece for the KTPs, validating that our insights are correct, such that when we give them back, that they're actionable and that our sort of recommendations are in some way useful. And as a personally, as a data scientist, there's nothing more appealing than being able to give back some analytics that have some real world impact.
And how long does the project have left to run?
So the entire project for this partnership with the University of Essex will extend until September next year. The trials themselves will be completed by the summer of next year in 2025. And we will be aiming to publish around that time as well, with some initial findings, particularly around the results of our validation study. But there'll be other publications too, in relation to the type of models that we'll be creating, all of which will be open source, and any kind of additional studies that we'll do on the side. So we're also doing some other side studies where we're exploring how, say, wearable devices plus the app itself can have an impact in terms of, say, people's general well-being. So the idea of us, you know, not just using our app to sort of go out and do a walking challenge, but that now we all have these smartwatches and actually even smart rings at the moment that we can connect to the app. And how does that impact it? What can we do to expand this kind of new era of tech in the space of health and well-being? So there's a lot more that we can kind of investigate, but ultimately, we should have some interesting publications out by this summer, and this whole study will wrap up by about September next year.
So findings published next summer. Any chance we could entice you back before that for a sneak preview of what you found?
More than happy to. Yeah, very happy.
Fantastic. We'll hold you to it. Thanks, John. It's been fascinating. I hope our listeners found it interesting, and hope to see you again on a future edition of the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, everyone.